You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome back to the DMZ, everyone. We are in a post-State of the Union, pre-Republican debate sandwich right now, as it were.
So it's the last President Barack Obama State of the Union. That's got to make you a little sad, right? Yeah, even if you're a Republican, yeah, it's been a ride. It's been an exciting time. You're not going to see that guy's mug behind the podium in the well of the House anymore. Did you miss up just a little? So give me a little.
No, I won't miss him, but I will say it is an end of an era, because, you know, Bill, you and I have basically been doing this the entire Obama presidency, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So I think our entire Blogging Heads relationship has overlaid the Obama presidency. So we've had some good times.
Now I feel like Obama is at his rhetorical best when he's puncturing Washington nonsense, and he's often played that role during the State of the Unions.
Right, but the problem there is, I think you can't call for civility and also mock people, which is sort of his two-step, the cognitive dissonance.
I've heard that critique, and I'm happy for you to expound on it. But I know you are often very objective when it comes to assessing Obama's rhetorical prowess. And so I was curious, when you were watching that, was there a part of you that said, this is going to make things a little harder for Republicans? If he's talking about how well the economy is doing or how strong our military is, does that make the relentless negativity in the Republican primary, does that make them look off target, petty, a little small? Or was your reaction was, it's Obama that is off kilter, the anger in the population is real, and Obama's fighting against the tide, and this is just a fresh target for Republicans to take a whack at?
So I have multiple things happening. On one hand, I think it's really hard to make the case that everything's great when, you know, at the moment there were 10 Navy sailors who had been captured by Iran.
Well, they're already released, right?
They've since been released, but I'm saying when he gave the speech, that was just one example. You've got, you know, North Korea testing nukes. You've got, you know,
that test was a failure.
Again,
how are these things so damning?
Okay, so first I would say I think that it's hard to sort of make a case that everything's rosy. On the other hand, I would say that I liked the idea of him explaining, and he had the one line, I think it was my favorite line of the night, and it was a big, I think it got a standing ovation, where he said, the United States is still the most powerful country on earth. I like that. That's a sort of
American exceptionalism.
I like that. We get so much bad news, and it is important to remember, for example, that although we keep hearing about these horrific shooting rampages, the murder rate's actually down, and you're arguably safer in the cities than you've ever been. And so I like hearing good news. I like someone who presents good news. My concern is, though, I think that, and this might be the product of the State of the Union address as a difficult speech to deliver, but if that had been the message, if he had given, like, if it had been very clear that that was his narrative, that it's morning again in America, don't listen to the naysayers, don't listen to the people who are upset, things are great, that would have been a great message. But of course it got clouded out by all sorts of other things that he had to say, some of which felt discordant with the what I felt should have been the narrative.
So do you think that at the end of it all, Obama's going to be seen as a contributor to incivility, not someone who ended up getting a lot done and actually attracted bipartisan support, you know, when it was available to him, and manage to break through the polarization as much as possible?
I think so. I think he's going to be, I mean, look, you've got a guy, there's sort of two things happening here. One, I think he really, just like George W. Bush, who also failed at this, he really ran on this notion that he was going to be a uniter, not a divider, that that there was going to be hope and change, that people were going to come together, and he failed to deliver. And although, obviously, Republicans bear part of the blame for that, I think he bears a lot of the blame. I think he's mocked Republicans. I think he's contributed to the incivility. I think his kind of heavy-handed manner and the fact that he decided to push through Obamacare early on, put points on the board for the Liberal Democratic Party, as opposed to going after other issues that might have gotten bipartisan support. So I think that, you know, he admitted last night during the State of the Union that this was an area where he failed. And I think that's a pretty big indictment, because one of the most important things a president of the United States can do is to sort of uplift people and inspire them. And it really feels like, despite some of the empirical evidence that might exist out there, it feels like we're coming unglued. And clearly the polarization and the bitterness is, you know, as bad as it's ever been, at least in modern times.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You point out, you know, Bush said this and it didn't work, and Obama said that it didn't work. I mean, could it just be that this is not something that presidents can solve? That there's something deeper here, that you, unlike 100 years ago, the two parties are based on ideological premises. That wasn't the case before. Before, you had parties that had different kind of demographic and geographic glue, and with, you know, pretty significant liberal and conservative wings on each side. And this is not the case anymore. The parties have been reshaped. You have a populace that is more mobile, so people are more willing and able to, you know, if you want to live in a big liberal city, go ahead. If you want to live in a conservative exurb, you can. And so you have polarization on that level. And you have a media that is, you know, invariably fractured. People can pick and choose the media sources that they get. I mean, that was true 200 years ago, but less true 50 years ago. Certainly true today. These are things that presidents can't solve. And the best you can do is to have as strong a partisan army as you can and pick off folks from the other side ad hoc. And that's how things are going to get done in the future. It's not the fault of a president if they can't magically change that.
Well, as you know, Bill, because you are very familiar with Too Dumb to Fail, my book, these are all things that I'm acutely aware of, these trends. And I think that there's some merit to that. It may be harder than it used to be to be a uniter and to sort of transcend the partisan divide. I still believe that it's possible, and I think that this is the NFL. This is the big leagues. And when you get to be president of the United States, one of the most important things you can do is to be president of the United States and to bring people together and to make them feel good about themselves. And if you fail, then it's like the Minnesota Vikings complaining about it being, you know, 2 degrees below zero or something when the kicker misses that field goal last weekend. Yes, the other side tries to stop you. That's what they do. Yes, the environment is hostile, but you are paid to get the job done. And if you don't get the job done, you have not delivered. I still believe that it is possible for leaders to lead and to persuade people. I believe Harry Truman, I'm probably paraphrasing here, but there's a quote, I think it's Harry Truman, something to do with leadership is about convincing people to do the things they should have had the good sense to do in the first place. You know, before Reagan became president, there was talk about maybe the job's too big for one man. You know, maybe the presidency, you know, with Jimmy Carter and the malaise, there was talk that, you know, maybe just nobody can get the job done anymore. I reject that. I believe that it takes the right man with the right, or woman, with the right temperament. And I feel, I would say, I feel like you have to, the one thing missing is the trying. It's the going and getting to know 435 members of Congress and having them screw you over and you calling them back up and trying to win them back over. It's that hard work of sort of making friends and influencing people that, like, I'll believe it doesn't work when someone tries it, like, actually tries it and it fails. But Bush, neither Bush nor Obama, and it's, I think Obama's been the worst about this.
Well, Obama struck out in 2014 on guns and on immigration. But then he came back and won on fast track and with the omnibus bill. I mean, so you haven't seen a guy just throw in the towel. I mean, when it's a different issue, he did pick up the phone. Fast track was done with mostly Republican votes, and some Democrats. I mean, so I can see what you're saying as far as, uniting the populace. Obviously, the populace is very polarized, but as far as the inside game is concerned, I feel like Obama is not a quitter. Obama has continued to reach out, case by case.
I think his idea of reaching out is reaching out to get people to do what he wants them to do.
Is that what Truman was saying?
Well, it's a two-way street, and I also get the sense. Now, I'm not, I'm not in Congress. I don't. Who knows? But it's sort of anecdotally, you get the sense that it's his way or the highway. That and he's spent a lot of time mocking Republicans and comparing them to terrorists in some cases, saying or sort of like dancing in the end zone, spiking the ball, reminding them I won. He basically attacked George W. Bush for, I don't know, but at least the first 4 years of his presidency, and blamed him for stuff.
Well, Reagan did that with Carter too, right?
You're a little before my time there. I'm sure it happens. I'm sure this always sort of happens, but I think he's taken it. My sense is he's taken it to a new level. Maybe I'm wrong.
On the Republican side, after I think a long string of just universally mocked Republican response to State of the Union, which is just inherently awful gig. So I don't, I don't want to be too mean about it. I mean, there's no way to do a really, actually no way, but it is almost impossible to do a good State of the Union response just based on the atmospherics. But Nikki Haley, governor of South Carolina, while not by any stretch universally praised, plenty on the right are mad at her, certainly getting some praise, certainly more praise than, Bobby Jindal got or Marco Rubio after, the water gaffe. I saw you had a very glowing piece about her speech. I saw Jeb Bush give her, big praise. It seems to be illuminating a divide. You said in your piece that she was speaking for the governing wing of the conservative movement, whereas sort of the Trump wing, the non-governing wing is angry with her because she is essentially taking implicit pot shots at Trump in an overheated rhetoric. I guess my question to you is, because she is magnifying the split within the party and the movement, has she done herself good or not? Is she queued up to be a vice presidential choice because she is showing that there is a young generation of non-white female Republicans that aren't like the Trumps? Or has she made herself polarized now she can't be picked because she can't unify the party?
I think it's the former, Bill. I think she's done herself a lot of good, and I think that she's the exact kind of person you'd want as a running mate. She's got bona fides amongst conservatives, with the exception of the sort of Trumpkins. And I think she appeals to the middle. She said, I do want to talk about some of the specifics here. So, in her response, she said, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices, but we must resist the temptation. Clearly, that was a veiled hit on Donald Trump. She, this morning on NBC, I believe it was NBC, corroborated that, in fact, she was talking about Trump. Charles Krauthammer called this last night on Fox. He said, it was the best written and best delivered answer to the State of the Union address I've ever heard.
That almost sounds like she's echoing Obama and echoing his comments about angry voices and responding more to Trump and Cruz, more so than just responding to Obama.
Well, I think that's you got to put it in context. She, if you go back to that quote where she said, it could be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. I think just the line before that, she talked about how these times are very troubled and scary. Which would be a veiled attack on President Obama, presumably. So I think she really found a middle way to respond to Obama and criticize his liberal agenda, but also to point out that this sort of populist, nativist response is an overreaction. Clearly it was interpreted that way by the Know Nothing Caucus. Trump should deport Nikki Haley, tweeted Ann Coulter. And I'm paraphrasing this tweet because there were like abbreviations, but basically Laura Ingraham said on Twitter, "Too bad Nikki Haley missed her opportunity to stand with working people who want borders enforced. American workers put first, and big government shrunk." So Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter both going after Nikki Haley, yet she's getting praised by the likes of Charles Krauthammer and Matt K. Lewis. So I think that puts her in the sweet spot of the governing conservative wing. And I think she would make assuming she's vetted, of course, that's always the caveat. I think she would make a fabulous running mate choice.
Now, she was chosen to do the response by Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So she and Ryan at this point, here's a guy who the left considers, an Ayn Rand disciple, but is increasingly seen by the hard right as an establishment figurehead.
Right.
So to the extent that we're calling Ryan and McConnell both establishment, I grant there's ideological distance between the two. This strikes me as a move by the party elders to marginalize Trump. It's not just Nikki Haley, taking a flyer. This seems to be a beginning of a coordinated response to ensure that a Trump or a Cruz does not become the nominee. And there's all sorts of debate going on whether a Trump or a Cruz would be unstoppable, if the party establishment's too weak to prevent them from running away with it. But do you see the establishment starting to line up their ducks to make sure that doesn't happen?
I don't know. I don't know if that's what it was, or if they just want to put sort of their best face forward. But I would say that it's a start. I think that Nikki Haley, in terms of diversity, in terms of temperament, and in terms of her, governing experience, personifies a very type of thoughtful conservatism that stands in stark contrast to the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. And I think that, it's interesting. Again, they want to talk about the establishment versus the grassroots. But the model where we talk about the establishment used to be Rockefeller Republicans who were pro-abortion liberal Republicans. Nowadays, the schism is incredibly different. You've got conservatives like Marco Rubio and Paul Ryan and Nikki Haley who are legitimate, young, up-and-coming conservatives versus the sort of Trumps of the world. And so I think that the paradigm is totally different when we call them establishment, if you will. I mean, if that's what we're going to call them, but they're real conservatives, but they just have a governing agenda.
I'm happy with governing versus non-governing. I think that's a fair delineation.
I don't think we've quite put our finger on exact. I'm even though I've written this book, I'm still toying around with like exactly what I should call these people, the know nothings or, you know, on the other side. I don't know. I will say, Bill, as you know, in my forthcoming book, Too Dumb to Fail, pre-order now. I have a chapter called "What the South." I think I changed the name of the title, but it's essentially what the GOP lost when it won the South. And the hero of that chapter is Nikki Haley. And it's because she took down the flag. And I think that was a courageous thing that she did. The flag is not conservative. In fact, it was Democrat-controlled state legislature that put it up there, I think, in the 1960s. Not to say that there weren't Republicans who supported keeping it, and not to say that all Democrats, of course, supported putting it up there. But the point being that I think Nikki Haley really came into her own at that moment. That was a defining moment. She stepped up, was courageous, did the right thing. If you believe that conservatism needs to win, you know, that the new South is, you know, we're going to have 21st century conservatives like Nikki Haley who can talk about ideas, not this cultural baggage that has nothing to do with philosophy. And I think that that's the kind of thing that really sets her up as a potential future star on the right.
Now, one of the arguments for saying that a Trump or a Cruz will get the nomination is that, unusually, this time around, the establishment is not united, has not consolidated around one candidate. And you, in particular, took umbrage to my man, Jeb Bush, after his affiliated Super PAC, Right to Rise, in the past week has run three, I would say the harshest ad so far of the campaign, targeting Marco Rubio. So two people, in theory, competing for the establishment's good graces to be a Trump or Cruz alternative. And you wrote a piece at the Daily Caller saying Jeb Bush loses what was left of his legacy because he is tearing down a promising figure for the future of the Republican Party. I recall, Matt, that you told the Ben Carson supporters, you know, suck it up when his guy was getting attacked. You have to go. You got to put through your paces.
Number one, I don't remember that. Number two,
I do not recall.
A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. You know that.
But isn't it true that if you're going to get the nomination, you're going to get attacked, and part of the deal is proving you can handle the attack so the voters know I'm not going to be blindsided in the general election? Anything that you know Jeb is saying now, or his Super PAC is saying now, I mean, and these there's a two prong attack in these ads if you haven't seen them. One hits the Senate attendance record, two hit the flip flopping immigration, and it all comes back to tagging Rubio as a quote Washington politician that you can't trust, I mean, that's an attack that he's going to get in the general election. I mean, that's not something that is only in the purview of the primary. I mean, Hillary Clinton could very easily attack him on immigration flip-flopping and being a lazy senator in the general election. So why not force him to prove he can beat that stuff back?
Well, look, at the heart of this is a debate over competition versus protectionism. And I think that clearly there are times when it's really helpful to be under attack and to sharpen your messaging. And then I think there are times when it's counterproductive. There was a Huffington Post study that was analysis the other week that showed that independent groups in the past year had only spent like $3 million attacking Donald Trump. I think that was the amount. Maybe it was like $2 million, whatever. Anyway, I think it was less than $3 million. And now you have Jeb Bush in the next 2 weeks is going to be spending like $3 million attacking Marco Rubio.
Well, the super
and
PAC.
So, with, I'm sorry, these outside groups. So it's Jeb Bush's super PAC. I think it's the Right to Rise, maybe. So this is the Mike Murphy, you know, group that Mike Murphy,
and just so people know, I mean, the bulk of the Bush war chest is in the super PAC. I mean, this is a particularly dominant super PAC for a campaign because Jeb was directly working with them before he announced. Almost all of the fundraising that occurred was on the super PAC's watch, and the super PAC is even providing some you know, grassroots staff. You know, typically they've been just air war. They've been doing some ground war. So you know, it's so, fair to you know to connect them.
Come on, if Jeb Bush wanted to call them off, he would call them off. He could do that.
No, he's already said publicly that he stands by those sorts of comments and. I just want to be a little.
Let me get to the crux. Let me get to the crux of the reason I don't like this. If Jeb Bush, now first of all, Marco Rubio is like in a distant third place, I think in Iowa and New Hampshire at best. Donald Trump is, there is a very serious possibility Donald Trump could win Iowa and New Hampshire and be off to the races. And rather than spending resources that to stop that from happening, Jeb Bush's people, supporters, are spending $3 million going after the one guy who probably has the best chance to stop him in terms of somebody who, you know, sort of shares Jeb's governing philosophy. I would say this, too. If I believed that Jeb Bush had a chance to win Iowa or New Hampshire, then I would say go for it. You want to win, Rubio's in your lane, then take him down. That's what politics is. This is not Jeb Bush trying to win. Jeb Bush cannot win. This is Jeb Bush taking somebody out with him. This strikes me as revenge. This strikes me as petty. This strikes me as Jeb Bush has no path to the nomination, and on his way out, he wants to drag Rubio down with him. So that's what bothers me, I think, about this one. If Jeb had a chance to win and Rubio was in his path, in his lane, then by all means, go after him.
Well, as you know, I think you were being unfair to my man Jeb. you know, Jeb's got no chance in Iowa. That's true. And Rubio is third there behind Trump and Cruz. Now, the Real Clear Politics polling average in New Hampshire, I think, is a different story. You have Trump clearly in first, averaging at 30. Then you have a lot of clustering. Rubio's actually technically second in the average. He's at 13. Then Kasich's at 11. Cruz is at 11. Christie's at 9.5. And Bush is at 9. You know, that's all within margin of error. That's all just a big cluster. And that Bush average is actually dragged down by an outlier poll. Monmouth came out yesterday, we had Bush at 4. But the other five polls in the RCP average has Bush between 8 and 12. So I would argue that Bush is really firmly in the pack there. I mean, he's spending a lot of time in New Hampshire. He's got a lot of money in ads, doing a lot of town halls. So it's not crazy. I mean, people have come, you know, so Bush is literally 4 points, 4.5 points behind Rubio in this polling average. That's not a gulf. You can make up that ground in 3 weeks, man. That's literally the margin of error. So, I think Bush's sole game is, if you can take down Rubio in both states, great. I mean, if Rubio got knocked down from his perch as third in Iowa, and Bush placed even fourth. You know, his bar is so low that people say, where? Jeb Bush come back? You know, if Bush comes to either win New Hampshire or become second behind Trump, you know, then he's off to the races after that. Then he has the mojo as the Trump-Cruz alternative. So that to me is a plausible scenario. I don't see why we should assume the Right to Rise just throw in the towel and just get by. You know, maybe at some point it's going to get there, but I don't think the numbers suggest that he's at that moment today.
All right. Well, that's a fair disagreement that we have. I'm operating under the assumption that Jeb Bush has no chance, and you're arguing that miracles happen, and you know, people. Well, no, but I mean, there are times that
believe.
People look. There are times that people look down and out, and then they come back, and maybe Jeb does that. So I think that we just disagree. Like, we just disagree on this fundamental question over whether or not Jeb is actually done or not. So that, you know, I think that this is like one of those things where good people can agree to disagree on this.
I mean, point. Certainly, I don't find it plausible that the Right to Rise people, that their strategy is, let's just screw Rubio for fun. I mean, I think they're trying to make their guy win.
I think they are screwing Rubio because they're angry that he betrayed his mentor. But let me say this. If you strike him down, he will become more powerful than you ever imagined.
I feel like when I've looked at the commentary on the ads, and I would argue I think they're probably some of the best ads of the cycle so far. But I feel like I see two diverging viewpoints. One is, this is so pathetic. Jeb Bush is making a joke of himself. These ads are ridiculous. You know, the goofiest one is the boots ad where you have this animated Marco Rubio dancing in his high-heeled booties, to quote the Cruz people, as he does this flip-flop dance. And it's this really hokey, cheesy song that they've created.
Yeah, I think that's just psychological warfare. I don't think that's meant to move any voters.
I think that one's just online. The other one's a TV ad. It's more of a classic TV ad where Marco Rubio is a weather vane with kind of a goofy smiley face and the weather vane spinning back and forth as he flip flops. That to me is very reminiscent of the 1988 George H.W. Bush Senator Straddle ad, which knocked Bob Dole off his perch after he won Iowa, and that allowed Bush to come back in New Hampshire. So
let me just say this: tell George Bush to quit lying about my record,
which is what Bob Dole said after he lost New Hampshire. So I guess my question is: do these ads make Jeb Bush look bad because they're so awful, or are they actually good ads? And the Rubio people are mad because they know they're good ads, and they're going to leave a mark.
No, I think that putting aside the stupid booty flip flop thing, some of the ads could leave a mark. I mean, look, none of these candidates are perfect. They all have legitimate areas that you could point out that would not make them look good, especially to a Republican primary audience. So I think that these ads are well done. You know, Eric Erickson, you know, the conservative blogger and talk radio host, wrote that it seems like Mike Murphy and the Jeb Bush Super PAC all of a sudden are taking glee in this, you know, like, in other words, the ads that they produced for Jeb weren't all that good, but all of a sudden they're making really compelling, flashy ads that are, you know, really good, that are meant to take down Rubio. It's almost as if they're taking a special sense of enjoyment in this project.
I want to ask you one more Rubio question before I shift to the Democrats. I meant to ask
and
you.
And then, Bill, I found out I'm probably going to have to jump even earlier than I told you.
Okay.
So let's just do another 10 or 15.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
cool.
Fine. All right. We'll go into the speed round.
You know, you've definitely looked at Rubio as an example of someone who can run an optimistic, uplifting, modern campaign. Do you think he is doing that right now, or is he having to bow to the Trump-Cruz way and get more dark and negative?
You know, Eric Erickson has this line that you will be made to care. I think that I'm working on a headline that's going to be called "You Will Be Made to Scare," which means that if you are a Republican politician, you will be made to scare people. You're going to have to play in that. I think David Brooks called it the sort of I think he said satanic messaging. It's sort of you're going to have to, if you want to win the Republican nomination, you're going to have to engage in some level of you know, tapping into the frustrations and anger and fear out there. I think Rubio does it best when he's talking about the foreign policy challenges, because it's authentic. He's something he cares very deeply about, is foreign policy. I think he really believes that Obama's foreign policy is very dangerous and disastrous. And so that's the best way that he can sort of scratch that itch and sort of keep up. Yeah, I absolutely think that Rubio has had to adapt and had to, you know, take a little bit of a page from the Trump and Cruz style. I don't think he's done enough of it that it damages him or makes him unelectable by any means. I just think that that he's probably tweaked his messaging a little bit to fit the spirit of the times.
And in fairness, I think Bill Clinton did that in 1992. He wanted to run as a third way centrist candidate, and then when Paul Tsongas came up, he veered left populist to dispatch Tsongas before he then went back to be more third way in the general election. So those types of fluctuations.
You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want. I will say this: for some reason I'm somewhat forgiving. I think that journalists in general, we have a very low tolerance for pandering and for bullshit and for transparent red meat hurling. But I'm sort of willing to look the other way. When Ruby has done this, it hasn't bothered me. I just sort of write it off as, he's got to do what he's got to do. But maybe it's because
there's implicit trust he's going to come back to where you are.
Yeah, I mean, and as you've noted in the past, Bill, I've dinged Rubio here and there. I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid completely, but I think he's got to do what he's got to do. And I do think that, when it comes to the foreign policy stuff, some people might call it fear-mongering, but I think he sincerely is worried, and I think that's an area where he's able to tap into that emotional thing that the base wants, while also, without being inauthentic. It's very sincere. So, anyway.
Well, before you have to run, I want to talk about the Democrats for a bit, because in the past few days we've had this Bernie boom in the polls, where he's leading New Hampshire now by a lot. He's closing the gap in Iowa, it's a bit of a head scratcher what exactly has happened, because it's not like there was some real flashpoint that occurred in the past week. I have my own theories. One is that this is my main theory. Bernie does best in these polls when there are no debates. There's all this conspiracy theorizing that the DNC is out to screw Bernie by not having a lot of debates and schedule them at off hours, but Hillary wins all the debates, and every time that happens, her polls go up because people say, okay, she's the commander in chief, she's more electable. Let's get serious now. And then when you have some distance from that, and it's just about whose economic critique you like best, Bernie, speaks to your heart, and then you get excited about that. And that could be a problem for Hillary, because there's a debate this Sunday, and then there's no debates until after Iowa and New Hampshire. This is the last debate for Democrats before Iowa and New Hampshire. They have one scheduled post New Hampshire. So there's that issue. I also wonder a bit if the Bill Clinton stuff, the rehashing of the past scandals, threw a wrench in the works for Hillary. They plan to roll Bill out as the surrogate in January, and that kind of dampened the hopeful boost to get out of that. I'm a little skeptical about how powerful that is, if only that it made it hard to get her own message out, that it just sort of stepped on her plan. I think the bigger issue for Hillary is, how does she get back to making this an electability contrast with Bernie when there are no debates after Sunday? And I certainly would not count her out. I would still expect her to win Iowa. And if she wins Iowa, you have to wonder if Bernie's numbers in New Hampshire will hold. Or if he does win New Hampshire, having a split makes it easier for Hillary to win the contest after that. The big fear for the Hillary campaign is going 0-2. Does that lead to a panic setting in? But I don't know if you're obviously on the outside of the Democratic electorate. I don't know if you have any thoughts on why Bernie is hitting a stride right now.
No, I'm not an expert, but I think it isn't. Clearly, there's something similar to the Trump phenomenon. This shows that it's bipartisan, that it transcends just the right, this outsider populist thing. My gut is that Bernie is just not up for the job. That Hillary's vulnerable, and if there were a Howard Dean that had gotten into this race, even an insurgent like Dean, that she could have been in real trouble. But I think that Bernie is a socialist grandfather He's like this avuncular guy, and I think he plays well in college towns, and I think he plays well in New Hampshire. I don't think he can turn the corner and go to the South and win African-American votes that he would need to win, even with the momentum if he were to go 2-0 in the early states. So I just – maybe I'm – again, I wonder the same thing I wonder about Trump. Maybe I'm like out of touch with everything, and maybe I'm totally underestimating Bernie, but I just cannot imagine the Democratic Party nominating him, whether or not he wins Iowa and New Hampshire.
No, I it would be very strange. Here you are. I mean, you know, Obama ousting Hillary in 2008 was an atypical development. You know, usually establishment people.
But I get it. But I at least get it because Obama is young and was young, charismatic.
We also had Iraq. I mean, Iraq was this huge albatross for Hillary. That not just the lefty base was mad at, but there are people, you know, in the upper echelons of the Democratic Party that were mad about that, and that conspired to, you know, box Hillary out, and that issue was really not at play here. You're coming off of, you know, 7 years of an Obama presidency that by and large Democrats like. It would seem, I mean, and there's definitely a history of dissatisfaction on the far left in Democratic presidencies. You had Huey Long against FDR. You had the anti-war faction, you know, breaking the party apart in the 60s with LBJ, despite the big wins on war on poverty and civil rights. So there are examples like that. But, you know, in the case, you know, 68 is different because of Vietnam. You know, the war on ISIS is not Vietnam. That's not an issue that deeply divides the party. People aren't getting drafted here. So it would seem, so even though it's not surprising that there's some element of that, it would be very strange for it to actually upend the party completely. And I think, as you point out, I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire are kind of tailor-made Bernie areas. These are not racially diverse primaries.
So it's official. I'm also an expert on the Democratic Party now, too. I think it's established. I know my stuff.
Yeah, so I do think, you know, Hillary could survive going 0-2, but yeah. it, even if she did, it would be a longer primary. Bernie would collect a lot more delegates, and the convention would be a lot more chaotic with Bernie delegates, you know, probably demanding big changes to the platform and not just right. having this be this hunky dory stage managed event. That's a more practical concern for Hillary.
My next book will focus on the schism on the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party. And we'll partner, and we need a clever title. We'll have a donkey on the cover.
But first and foremost, you have to go buy Matt's book now. This is
Too Dumber.
January 13th. We are less than 2 weeks away for the publication of Too Dumb to Fail. The excitement is building. Woo-hoo. And I expect there to be confetti and parades and all sorts of hullabaloo on the 26th. I look forward to the complete rollout.
It's going to be fun, man. Please get the book. Pre-order the book. I think you'll like it. And yeah, man, it's getting close. A couple weeks, countdown begins. So I've only been – we've been at this for years now. So payoff's about to come, man. Good times. I should fly you down for one of my book parties.
And the timing could not be better because the party has only gotten dumber. Am I right?
Things, you know, when I started writing the book, Trump wasn't even running, to give you an idea of how things have gone. You know, Dr. Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention wrote a piece the other day where he mentioned books he wants to read in 2016. My book was one of them, and he said something about Matt Lewis should buy a Powerball ticket. Because I got so lucky with Trump getting in the race, so
yeah,
seeing the stars are aligning.
I'm excited. Go get the book as soon as possible. I know you're gonna be pretty busy the next 2 weeks. We got to work out when we can chat again. I know you got a lot of stuff to do, but we'll figure it out.
All right. Thank you, Bill Scher, and thank you, Blogging Heads community and DMZers, and we'll see you soon back in the DMZ.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.